Mel, Cindy was just introducing us to the some of the issues with the paper that have been sort of pervasive right now in terms of the idea of the not getting vaccinated due to it. And I just thought I'd highlight the fact that I can't remember the exact stats, but I was reading something in Alberta the other day. I think the new COVID booster, it was like less than 20%, I think it was picked up. And then the influenza was like 25%. So, I mean, yeah, we're like bottoming out in terms of vaccination levels right now, particularly in Alberta, but I know that's the case in other places. Mel, do you have any thoughts about the paper or things you wanted to touch base before we jump into it more detailed with Cindy?
Wanted it to be made clear that the grifters and the liars out there, they will manipulate the information in that paper to serve their purposes, right? We're seeing a massive coordinated effort online, social media trolls, the blue check marks from Russia. They're discouraging vaccinations in all areas, from mommy groups and Facebook to online to church groups, you name it. Any and all conspiracy theories about vaccines, they're pushing it, about it changing your DNA, about it doing this. And you know, it takes a while for scientists and scholars to come up with papers to discredit these wild theories. So the damage has already been done. So in hopes of, with Cindy translating this IgG4 paper that is being wildly misinterpreted out there and misrepresented, hopefully we can gain some clarity and help parents and caregivers understand that vaccines are really important right now. And gosh, guys, the flu vaccine is so easy. My little guy did it. It's a squirt up the nose. It's no different than a nasal spray. And it saves lives. And we've had 3 kids die in the last 10 days already of secondary bacterial infections from influenza and complications from influenza. It's so important. Like, what is a little nose spray going to do? Like, it protects them. So I'm going to hand the mic over to Cindy and let her translate that difficult paper for us. Thanks, Cindy.
I just wanted to say before Cindy jumps in is like, and this started in 2020, right? Like, this started in the conversations we had. And let's say that anti-vaccination campaigns have existed long before sort of the COVID pandemic hit, but they were in pockets, right? We saw these sort of groups of people that would do this, but the proliferation of media, the proliferation of misusing scientific knowledge, that's something we've been talking about for 4 years now. And unfortunately, we saw, you know, people as high up as Dr. Bonnie Henry in British Columbia, right? When we were talking about vaccines, that she said they were needed, but then eventually, well, it was personal protection and people didn't need to, and we're not even at the level where we're going to have herd immunity anymore. So we've watched sort of the degradation of the vaccine system across the last 4 years. And unfortunately, our public health officials have played a role in that even at times. So we're watching the outcomes of that now. And that's something, again, you could probably listen to a podcast we recorded 3 years ago. And that's what we said would be coming down the line. And again, we're in the find out part of the fucking around now. And this is why we have these really poor outcomes and really low vaccination rates and people not understanding that we're still in a pandemic.
Yeah, very true. The misinformation has been horrifying. You know, and I see, just looking in the space, we have a lot of amazing advocates on the Twitter space with us today. And so as I go through a little bit here, I'm going to try to also explain some of the terms and things that I'm using. So our advocates and people listening, if they're trying to communicate this to others, they can kind of have some verbiage to use to translate it to others and communicate why the vaccine is safe, you know, and why we need to continue to get boosted. You know, it's not just to protect ourselves. It's also to try and stop or put a dent in that forward transmission, because when you are boosted and vaccinated, you don't produce as many virulent particles to expel out of your body, right? So that's important for people to know too.
Yeah, I love it. I think a lot of what we've done, sort of trying to do on Project Canary Podcast is knowledge translation, right? That's a huge piece of what I've been interested in, both sort of in this advocacy space, but also, you know, in the work I do, whether it's working with the clients I have with psychology, breaking everything down to the point of that we can all use it, because the information is there, but most people do not have the language or the background or the experience to really be using it in effective ways. But the more we can arm people with knowledge that is actually accessible, that they can have a, you know, calm and informed conversation with somebody about this, the more likely it is to make change. Because when we can't have those conversations, when we can't push with it, we don't get anywhere. But sometimes I like to believe, and this is my optimistic side, that like, maybe if I explain this to 20 people, one of them will pick this up, and that one person will get one person, and we have to make change somewhere. And I think everyone probably in this space has continued to do that across the last 4 years. And regardless of whether it feels successful sometimes, we continue to do it because we do believe that we can make change.
Very true. And if you're ready, I can jump in. I posted one thing I put up on my whiteboard, just a small diagram that I'm going to be referring to that people can have a peek at if they want. And then I didn't put any of the other diagrams in because we'll just talk about it. So in these IgG4 papers, you know, they're talking about the class switch towards non-inflammatory spike-specific IgG4 antibodies after repeated SARS-CoV-2 mRNA vaccines. And what I wanted to talk about is this, well, I'll start with this one paper where they had a look at people who had three mRNA Pfizer vaccines. So that's the Comirnaty now. And that they didn't mix and match, you know, and it's important to note right off the get-go that they didn't see this with the J&J adenovirus vector vaccine. They didn't see this with the mix and match vaccines. So if you're doing like a AstraZeneca or J&J or Novavax, mixing them with your mRNAs. This was specific to mRNAs only, and this was specific to Pfizer only. So they had two cohorts. In the first cohort, they had 29 people, which is a small sample size. So they recognized that right off the hop, and they used a second cohort of 38 people to both compare and verify their results. So that's good because they recognize that's a small study. So that's a limitation people would raise an eyebrow about. And then they did the first and second dose was in people who had it 3 to 4 weeks apart. So this was at the onset. This was the kind of the normal course of things where we saw the healthcare workers being vaccinated first. And these are the people who volunteered for this study. They were healthcare workers. So then they 7 months after they had their third dose, and this is a longitudinal study, meaning they continued to look at this for over 200 days. And what they wanted to see was the antibody response after each vaccination. They looked at it 10 days after each and 210 days after the second dose, 180 days after the third dose. And they made observations based on the antibody types and levels in the Pfizer vaccines versus the adenovirus, the levels, performance, and classes of the antibodies, and with IgG4 being a class. And they wanted to know, what does the performance look like? Is it neutralizing? Is it binding? What's going on? They wanted to look at the avidity of antibodies, and they wanted to look at ADE, which is antibody-dependent enhancement functions. And that includes some other functions, ADCO, ADCC, ADCD, which I'll explain later. And these are all encompassed under the ADE. And what's interesting about this paper, and a lot of anti-vaxxers tried to say, oh, look at this is causing ADD, when actually this paper shows the opposite. In all of those ADE enhancement functions, what they saw is that they were reduced by IgG4, which is a good thing. And just completely, you know, shoots the narrative that the anti-vaxxers were trying to twist this paper to say, which it doesn't. So among the major findings, they found that IgG4 continued to increase while other antibodies waned. So if you look at that chart I popped up in the Nest, right at the start, it was the second vaccine. So the first shot isn't indicated there, but you'll see after that second shot, there's a decrease. And then the third shot, there's an increase in the IgG1, 2, and 3 antibodies. And then it's not until the third shot where you see that rise in IgG4 antibodies. So before the third shot, an increase in IgG1 antibodies was seen. And IgG1 antibodies, they are pro-inflammatory protective antibodies. That's a good thing. Those are the antibodies we want to see. You know, after the first shot, the IgG4 was not even present, but the IgG was present. Then after the second one, the IgG1 antibodies were the same, and the IgG4 starts to be seen at a low percent. Then after the third shot, the IgG1 drops, and the IgG4 levels rose to about 20% of all spike-related antibodies, not all antibodies, just the spike-related ones. So this is not all the antibodies in our bodies being perceived, you know, to be IgG4. It's just spike-related antibodies. So that's how, you know, that got turned into the IgG4 disease and turbo cancer garbage. It's also really easy to overlook or omit the actual relative percentage change. And people often will look at this and they'll only look at the IgG4 that it has changed. And they'll see, oh, look, the IgG1 no longer exists. And the way they're reading it, it makes it seem like we're in trouble. And that's not the case at all. The IgG1 being the most important pro-inflammatory antibodies still remained high in about the 70% range, you know, and that helps against infections. So we know that those antibodies wane after 2 to 3 months, but interestingly, the IgG4 rose after 2 to 3 months, a slow rise, you know, and before it started rising, there's that gap I drew on that diagram that shows where more people were experiencing opportunistic infections prior to the IgG4 rising. Because the IgG4 is pro-inflammatory, it is a pro-inflammatory antibody, and it also helps against infection. It's a good thing. People think it's bad. It's not bad. So it's misunderstood there. We'll put it that way.
Cindy, if we break it down at this moment, why do people think it's bad right now? Like, what are they using to suggest that?
Well, I think if they look and just start their Googling fingers, they would type in IgG4 and something might pop up about IgG4 related diseases, or there's an actual IgG4 mediated disease itself. And out of control, it can also be indicative of cancer, pancreatic cancer. IgG4 levels are high, you know, so I think that's where they kind of grabbed that and ran with that.
Right. So it's taking this global term of IgG and misapplying it to say that it's linked to all these things, which is completely separate from the very specific pro-inflammatory antibody that we're talking about with respect to vaccines.
Absolutely. You know, it's also important to note that IgG4 antibodies do not even cause IgG4 disease by themselves, you know, and people don't understand that. So, B cells that produce IgG4 are incorrectly activated when it comes to IgG4 disease. It's not the IgG4 itself, right? So the fibrosis, the liver damage, the pancreas damage, the cancer, it's because of the cytotoxic T cells. Because then when the B cells are dysregulated, they keep presenting antigen to T cells, and it could be healthy tissue. And they're like, oh, look, there's something wrong here. And then because they keep presenting it to the T cells, they start attacking your own tissue, because the B cells are persistently telling these T cells it's a threat when it's normal, when it's a normal body tissue. So
it's a downstream effect of something but the two things can look similar, so they're assuming that both causes are the same.
Yeah, so yeah, it's the T cells that are actually causing the problem. Like even with somebody with IgG4 disease, you don't ever just look at IgG4 in the blood. You know, that's not a standalone thing. They don't even use it as a diagnostic marker because it's not accurate. They use integration of clinical, radiologic, serologic, and histologic factors to make that diagnosis. So, you know, so they've conflated so much about this.
So if I can spin this, because I'm always trying to find different analogies, and I want to hear from you if you think this is correct. Because what's coming to my mind is a recent case that I was working with in terms of fatigue can be an outcome of many things, right? So people can experience fatigue. And in this case, if I take an example of someone I'm working with related to post-COVID, or they can have fatigue related to depression. Right. But a lot of people will take this client's fatigue and just assume that it's part of depression, whereas there's many different causes that can come to fatigue. It's a symptom of something, but it doesn't tell us what it's a symptom of. There's still a lot more upper level things that you have to differentiate. But technically, people could just say all fatigue is depression. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And then there's definitely some similarities, you know, and even just seeing the numbers, because if they look at this paper, they're seeing that IgG4 rises to about 19%. And they're like, oh my God, you know, because the IgG4 related disease are present in people who have about 40% of their immunoglobulin antibodies of all their antibodies. And this paper is just talking about spike specific antibodies. So it is a fraction of all of our antibodies, you know, so, and that's where they grab that and misinterpret it. And then they go off on their anti-vax nonsense, you know, not really being qualified to speak in the area they're trying to speak in, which is really frustrating, you know. And then they're saying, well, where's the IgG1? Well, it remained, you know, in the lower 70 percentile right through to the third dose, even at 180 days, you know, and then it continues to wane. And that's why we need to get boosted. But the IgG4 stayed and offered some protection, which is good. That's what we want to know. So, and that's what we want to see.
I think it's a beautiful example and something that we've tried to highlight across the podcast. So of the misinterpretation, both with malice and without, that happens and perpetuates these ideas, because, you know, it could be a handful of people that are doing this with malice in terms of they really buy into this and want to, you know, sell their supplements or do something else. But very, very easily, if it sounds convincing enough and you have numbers to use with it, that it will sweep out. And how many people now are citing this paper and utilizing these findings to state that people shouldn't get vaccinated and it's working?
Well, it is, you know, and aside from the IgG4, they're trying to make a case for class switching. Well, all of when
B cells... Can you define class switching for us?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. So it's all predetermined by a human immunoglobulin gene locus, right? So what happens... when the class switchings, maybe I'll back up a little bit. So with naive B cells, immunoglobulins are made up to the D and M antibodies. So they always produce IgM and IgD together. That's how it is in the gene code. They can't do it any other way. It's and then they get to a break in the code. So then they go on and that's called class switching. When they get that break in the gene code, that's class switching. So they're going to go from the IgM and the IgD antibodies, and then they're going to go to the interleukins, and then they're going to class switch again, you know, and then they're going to go to the classes. So that's your immunoglobulins 1, 2, 3, and 4. But that's all predetermined by the human immunoglobulin gene locus. You can't change that. mRNA vaccine isn't going to change that. It's just doesn't work that way, you know, but they'll take that and they'll run with that and they'll misinterpret it and put their own words in. And it's just like, it just doesn't mechanistically work that way, you know? So to try to explain that,
Like, so the, if I'm extrapolating in my brain and thinking of people that are misusing this, are they suggesting that the mRNA is changing that process itself rather yes. than it simply impacting the number of the IG4s in terms of that's just an outcome of the vaccine itself, but they're saying it's actually changing the DNA structure and the replication structure.
Yeah, yeah, they're saying it's changing it, which is, it's impossible
for which that. Makes no sense at all.
Right, yeah, right, it doesn't change at all, you know. So it's interesting how they take this and twist this, but mechanistically it just is impossible. But it's so complex and complicated when you try to explain it to them, you know, they just take a little bit and twist it, and you have to basically explain a whole textbook to explain why it doesn't work that way, if that makes sense.
You have to explain to them, what is an immunoglobulin, what is this, what is that. I mean, the people who are twisting it is banking on the normal layperson not having the biology background or the science background to comprehend the complexities of this.
Well, and let's be real. Like, when I did my Bachelor of Science, I really liked immunology and virology. So I took almost all of my electives in that. And I can barely understand this, okay? Like, I have to review my textbooks to have this conversation with you, Cindy. So I can imagine that people who've had no exposure to it, right? It's like a foreign language. So it's very easy to just insert pieces of this and make it sound good. I mean, I can speak to the psychology side of that, right? That people are very easily influenced, right?
Definitely. You know, and then it's just so frustrating to try to explain this to them. I tend to just find some skill testing questions before I engage in further conversation. And then I'll know if I'm just talking to somebody who's, you know, just twisting this, or who wants to feel important. And
well, and I think you just said the highlighting word there for me, and people aren't going to like this answer, but it's true, which is people feel certain ways, and how they respond to what we say to them and what they believe in is affected by what they want to feel about it. So there's a significant portion of the population that we could give them all of the straight facts about something and show them how logically it follows a certain process, but that actually will not matter to them because they feel a certain way. And that is exactly what people such as those grifting supplements and all those who want them to act and do a certain way, think a certain way, utilize. They rely on that structure of humans and get them feeling a certain way. And then they know they're off to the races. It's not actually going to matter what logic we come up with. So that's why it's tapping into, you know, the outrage of people and making them think that, you know, they're going to get cancers, instilling fear in them, distress, all that sort of stuff, for the purposes of bringing them along without having to have the logic behind it.
Yeah, and people get married to their ideas, you know, and scientists included. It's really hard to invest a lot of energy and time and money into an idea, and then when it's found to be wrong, you know, or you can't replicate it, you have to abandon the whole thing and go back to square one. There's an awful lot of scientists who can't do that.
And, well, and it's humility, right? Yeah. That's the last podcast that we recorded 6-7 months ago was on the topic of scientific humility, that science is based on learning, on iterations, on improving the knowledge that we have. And too often scientists get caught in this process of they really want something to be a certain way, it makes sense with their logic, and then they stop looking for other answers. But that's not science, and that's not the scientific process. If you're not open to alternatives or explaining how your theory does or does not fit with it, you're not doing science. Science is about falsifiability and integration of those theories, and we all have to be able to do that.
100%. And that's so important. And there's so many who can't, you know, personal reasons, financial reasons, and we're seeing it lifetime through a really amplified lens through this pandemic, you know. So that integrity and ethics piece is massive. It is so massive. And if the funding models were different, you know, I think we would see a higher level of integrity across the board.
We And I'd say specifically in North America, I'll speak to, because I haven't lived anywhere else, so I don't want to speak to that, is we haven't fostered those characteristics as useful, though, in our society. We have fostered this sense of individualism, of competition, of sort of getting what's yours. We haven't fostered the factors like ethical practice, humility, those things that would actually bring us forward are not things we've focused on. And I think you see that when you look out as to what's popular, what becomes, you know, click-worthy, any of that sort of stuff in our society. It's not, we're in sort of like the pit of hell when it comes to what characteristics we rely on. And unfortunately, that has come across in our public health responses as well, right? Like I look to, you know, 2020, 2021, the sort of glorification of Dr. Bonnie Henry in BC and her becoming a celebrity and being invited to these awards and getting honorary degrees, all while people like my grandma were dying, right? Well, a third of her care home died and everyone in that home got sick and she was being glorified at that time. And we watched on with horror, but that is what was normal for our society.
That's horrifying. Yeah, Bonnie Henry's a trigger word for me, and I think a lot of other people. She's been among the worst as far as our pandemic response is concerned in Canada.
Well, and the juxtaposition of how bad her response was with how glorified she was painful for a lot of us from BC to watch, because, you know, she's getting like blankets made of her and all these award systems, while we know in the background that they were withholding vaccines from Indigenous peoples, while they were making all these choices that harmed some of the worst off in our province and getting glorified for that. And that continues, right? That continues. Where is public health right now? Gone. Public health in Canada is fucking gone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, so this IgG4 papers, they're not saying what these anti-vaxxers and grifters are wanting them to say. You know, they actually showed that IgG4 has a higher avidity compared to other IgGs. So avidity means like a total binding affinity of an antibody, and an affinity is just one variable region of an antibody. And this is interesting because when B cells are making those antibodies, they reside in germinal centers in our lymph nodes. And in those lymph nodes, we have special cells called follicular dendritic cells, and they continue to train our B cells to improve affinity. That's an affinity maturation. And that's done with the memory B cells and the follicular dendritic cells. And they continue to train. And every time the binding is improved, the affinity is improved. So the avidity is improved as well. You know, like, IgG has 2 sites to bind. IgM has 10. Ig has 4 sites. So the B cell behavior is actually being improved. So this rise in IgG4 is a really good thing. It's adding protection, and it's totally knocking their theories about ADE out of the water. It's not what people think it is. Like there's with ADE, there's other subtypes that are happening. So one of them is called ADCC, and that's antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. So that's, you know, a macrophage will go poke holes in a virus and insert granzymes, and that kills it. That was lowered with IgG4, you know, so that the ADCD, antibody-dependent complement deposition. You know, that's what triggers your liver during your acute phase of an infection to make proteins. It triggers the complement system. And that when that's happening, the membrane of the virus is attacked and the virus can't survive because its inside contents are spilled out. You know, so all these ADE mechanisms, they're reduced in the presence of IgG4. And why it's a good thing is because it is reducing the impact and the occurrence of the cytokine storm. And that's what progresses to a really dangerous situation and where we see death. So they're taking that and saying, oh, look, the immune system switched off. No. We want those things dampened. Like there's a balance that needs to be had, right? But that's how they're convoluting it. With the rise in the IgG4, they're also seeing less mast cell activation. You know, so I hypothesize that a lot of the vaccine injuries happen only after one, possibly two vaccines, and that somebody who has had three vaccines of the same kind, properly spaced apart, not too close together, it would, unless it was something like anaphylaxis or something that you're going to see right away, you know, that's probably where vaccine injuries are, like true vaccine injuries, not just COVID infections that progressed to long COVID that people weren't aware of, are happening, you know. So that's just my hypothesis. I have no proof of that. I don't believe it's been studied, but I'd love to see it studied. You know, another important thing about this study was that they only saw the increase in IgG4 in about half of the study participants. And remember, all of these participants had the same kind of vaccine, the Pfizer mRNA, at the same distances apart. So that speaks to rates of seroconversion, you know, and you have to then look deeper. Why are some people not seroconverting? And what about people who do seroreversion? So that means their body works against it, so they don't have any antibodies. That's happened in some HIV patients on PrEP. You know, they end up not having any antibodies at all. So that's really interesting things to continue to look further into about what is happening when, and how can we make it more accessible for people to know, hey, what are my antibodies doing? Have I seroconverted? Do I need another booster instead of this garbage blanket strategy of trying to make it like the flu and only offer boosters once a year? Some of those people may not need a booster. Some of them may need a booster at 3 months. Some may need it at 6 months. You know, it's really, really discouraging to think that this is how our public health is.
And that we're this far in and we are still not making those methods easier to access and utilize. Like, this is something that we have been aware of and should have been working on from the very start. But instead of doing that, we've been working to minimize COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so important for people to work together on this and to find solutions and better methods of testing to make interacting safer, you know, and to develop tests so we can see what's happening with people, what's happening with persistent virus. Is it replicating? You know, all these questions, big questions, important questions that need to be answered, and they're kicking a fucking can down the road. You know, it's really infuriating and discouraging.
Well, and they are, and it's still, what's fascinating to me from the psych perspective is having watched this from the start, is that there's been such work to minimize what's happening because of it, but at the same time, it's all around me. So I work in a clinic now that does more physical, like physical med health. So we've got physio, occupational therapy, kinesiology, psychology, those sorts of things. So a lot of people coming in with issues like chronic pain, traumatic psychological injuries, that sort of stuff. Post-COVID and post-COVID syndrome is something that is coming up regularly in my clinic, that people are aware of, that there's research out there, that that clients are coming in knowing that there's an impact from it. Yet we still don't work to mitigate it anywhere. So it's this complete separation still that's going on of the fact that people are recognizing they're A, still getting sick from COVID, B, there's a lot of long-term effects happening all around them, yet C, I'm the only person in Walmart if I have to grab something that's wearing a mask still.
Yeah, and you know, and the masking is a whole other piece. They're actively campaigning against it with the false narrative that masks don't work. Well, no, if you do your study based on baggy blues with low rates of compliance, they don't work. You know, but well-fitted N95s, they have been proven over and over to work very, very well.
And we've also seen that they argue masks don't work, but then they also argue that they made kids' immune systems change and that they caused all these problems. You can't have it both ways, right? So, you know, saying that all these kids are getting so much more sick because they wore masks for like 3 months during the school year in BC But at the same time saying they don't work. Again, there's no logical consistency with the arguments that are being made, but it doesn't matter if it hits people in the feels. If they feel that it gives them the right to not wear a mask, the right to do what they're doing, they're going to sort of leech onto that because, of course, that's what feels good to them.
And they have to continue to find other arguments to support their narrative so that they're not wrong. You know, I'm happy to be wrong. If anybody, you know, ever came to me and said, hey, I found something contradictory, I'd be like, okay, let me see it. And, you know, I would never be like, oh, no, I don't want to see that. Or I always try really hard to keep an open mind, you know, and I take it personally when other people don't. And then I have to remember, you know, not everyone's a trained scientist and everyone has different personalities, right? Because I'll be excited about some new research that disproves something else. You know, for example, the latest fluvoxamine studies. So they did a meta-analysis and it really showed it really didn't help. And that was disappointing because some people had a lot of hope, you know, in fluvoxamine for COVID and long COVID. And people are just like, no, it does work. I'm like, no, according to the research, it had no clinical significance, sadly. You know, and we really have to continue to push for evidence-based medicine, you know, because if we go with all of the naturopathy and hokey medicine that is not evidence-based, you know, I always say if it worked and there was evidence that it worked, it would be evidence-based and it would be in mainstream medicine, you know? So it's just, there's safety checks and there's questions of this either works or it doesn't. And then there's quality control with supplements. And I'm not saying don't take any supplements and nothing outside of mainstream medicine, you know, it all doesn't work. But I'm saying even your doctor will say what supplements are helpful and which ones aren't and where you should get them. You know, it's just kind of a wild west out there as far as naturopathy and supplements. And we have this conspiracy theorist as a premier in Alberta, which is terrifying because she's down the rabbit hole of crystals and ivermectin. And wow, I can't even with her. Like, I don't think I've ever known a more gullible person in a position of power.
Help from Alberta, help.
We're crying in Albertan. Yes, help.
I saw that post about this woman's brother-in-law who refused to take Paxlovid. He was positive with COVID-19, but because Danielle Smith told him he could drink tonic water to cure COVID, he died the next day. He literally didn't seek any treatment
for his symptoms
and just said, you know, I'm just going to drink this tonic water because she made a post about it online. And it is a Wild West out there because I went and was, you know, I'm doing my usual poking around social media and checking out the mommy groups. And here's a mommy saying that her 5-year-old son has been having a cough for the last 6 months and it won't go away. So when she put him in a salt cave and let him and rented a salt cave for him for 4 hours and he sat in a salt cave and played with his trucks, his cough went away. Because apparently salt caves and crystals will cure his asthma and other respiratory conditions. And I'm just thinking, oh, okay, so what about the person after who used the salt cave? Did they catch all his viruses that he just trapped in there? It's just mind-blowing to me.
Stalagmites or stalactites? What's your poison today?
Well, and the thing is, if we actually had an open scientific process to be utilizing, it would be really helpful, right? Is that we've spent so much time over the last few years wanting to say that COVID won't have any impacts, that we're so behind in where we should be in understanding how to treat and deal with the issues that we have to even test for them, that it's just, yeah, outrageous as I watch my clients, you know, deal with the outcomes of this. and have nowhere to go or can't get into specialists, particularly as, you know, we're not even adding the fact that the healthcare system is collapsing as this still goes on. So people, it's taking longer and longer and longer for them to get any sort of care at all.
That's so true. I just saw a post by YYC Cowboy. He tells us all of our Albertan ER time waits and what's happening there. And he had to go in for emergency surgery and was sent back home and couldn't get his surgery because of the long waits. I forget the exact times on his post, but if someone wants to look, his handle is YYC Cowboy. And it's horrifying to me.
Well, and Daniel, I'll get to you in a second, but I just want to mention, you know, as we're talking about this, because it's on my mind, is that we're not even addressing the fact that Canada is in the process of changing all of their MAID policies, right? And I've talked about this on the podcast before. I am very much a supporter of MAID. In terms of people having autonomy, making those decisions, but they're about to add mental health onto it, and they don't even cover mental health therapy in Canada. So we are creating systems where people will completely bottom out and not have access to any sort of resources, and then allowing them to access MAID. And again, I support MAID, but in my clinic, where there's a 2 to 3 year wait list for a chronic pain patient, but they can get in 6 weeks to talk to someone about MAID, we really need to understand how much the system is failing people right now. Daniel, what's up?
Yeah, we talk about the vaccines and you know, their response and asking people to get them, and there's vaccine uptake issues, possibly impaired vaccine response in those living with a chronic SARS-CoV-2 infection because they're depleting CD4 cells. And Jason Oculitz looked at this years ago with the hepatitis B vaccine. And, you know, we continue to talk about vaccines, and what we're doing is ignoring those living with a chronic SARS-CoV-2 infection. And if we were to say, hey, you know what, we've got another framework here that we could borrow from, we would stop disease progression and forward transmission, because Paxlovid is not the way to go. Because there were several assumptions made with it that are just illogical. Number one, that an individual has this, every individual that takes their first pill has the same viral load when they initiate, and that they all experience the same reduction in virus with every single pill that they take, that there aren't reservoirs involved, which we know that they are, and that they've completely eliminated all the virus at day number 5. That's just illogical. There's no way that that would even be possible. And so, you know, the strategy that we should be looking at, if we want to save lives and prevent new cases, is treatment as prevention. But we've drug our feet on adopting a pill-based strategy for so long that we sit here without the tools necessary to pull it off, which would be a viral load test, where we could measure viral load and respiratory secretions. And we're not engaging in drug repurposing trials at all. And so these reservoirs that have been observed since 2021, December of 2021, by Dr. Chertow, they're continuing to expand while CD4 populations, cognition, liver function, and kidney function are all declining.
Yeah, but you're not going to measure viral loads in mucus secretions past the acute phase, right? They're finding the reservoirs deep in tissues, and they're finding them by autopsy.
Well, I mean, they have found, there was a study that was done, looking at log copy reduction out of Europe using Truvada. So, I mean, we know that it works, right? I would imagine that we would be able to endeavor in some way of determining what an individual's viral load is. Because again, people don't like non-pharmaceutical interventions, and people are anti-vax, and we're just adding to the pile of disabled, and then we'll eventually be adding to the pile of the dead. I mean, this is just ludicrous that we're sitting here in this position. We're spinning our wheels for no reason whatsoever. And once those kidneys and livers have been impaired to a certain degree, death is the only option. You're not going to initiate antivirals. Anybody on dialysis, their kidneys are already shot to the point they'll never take an antiviral. They'll be left to die. And I mean, that's the bottom line. You can read prescribing guidelines if you disagree with me, and you'll see that there are minimum requirements for kidney and liver function. So, if we don't do something, we're just going to have massive death on our hands. Massive death. And, people in Victoria, there's an explosion of cryptosporidiosis in Victoria and in Australia. And there's, I believe in Canada, there's tuberculosis popping up. There's tuberculosis popping up all across the United States. People in England are being eaten alive by cryptosporidiosis. These are all age-defining illnesses. So, we've got to wake up and do something unless we want people to die a horrific death, because many already have. Over 1 million people died of tuberculosis last year despite being HIV negative, and there was only one other virus observed on Merck Medical's website that depletes CD4 cells, allowing for its reactivation at a CD4 nadir of 500, and that's SARS-CoV-2. So, it's time to, I think, pursue some other option,
China is repurposing HIV medications right now for the general population, aren't they?
Like, yes, they are.
They're handing them out like Tic Tacs to their population after they came out of lockdown. China came out of lockdown. They re-engaged. They engaged the let it rip, policy. And now they're like, oops, that was a bad idea. And they're actually handing out antivirals to their population, which is something that I've been watching too.
Well, I think this, I'll touch on a few things which I can agree with, which is we've ignored the outcomes, right? Whether that's what we can be doing for testing for viral loads, whether it's the medications we can be using for prevention, but also, importantly, all of the people that are dealing with long COVID right now and sort of post-COVID outcomes, is that this is a pretty significant portion of the population at this point in time. And we've had research for some time to indicate that a lot of people have extenuating symptoms way past the acute phase. And we sort of continue to sit on that and not do much with that in terms of the actual medical system and addressing that. And it's at some point, it's also overloading our health system that's failing as it is as well.
Well, and we have a microbial resistance problem, too, if we want to talk about tuberculosis. It's a long slog to be treated for tuberculosis, and we already are experiencing issues as a society with microbial resistance. So you throw something like SARS-CoV-2 in the mix, it's a bigger problem.
Well, and as we've talked about, across the podcast, is we've taken approaches before, to issues, but never like the COVID pandemic, where we just balls to the walls stopped doing anything in the middle of the pandemic and just kept at that. And we continue at it today, right? Like, we have hospitals overflowing, people are still dying, we are still developing, viral changes en masse because we don't take the basic measures. It's still ongoing, and we are complete blinders on societally. And the outcomes of that, I think, you know, I put an article up on my account before we started this about a study that was looking at a national biobank in terms of linking viral infections and later neurodegenerative diseases, which is one of the things I'm really interested in as part of COVID. And, you know, that the more long-term data we have on things, linking viral illnesses to things like Alzheimer's, to the disease, to things like multiple sclerosis, right, that we are such in the baby phase of COVID right now that it's hard to imagine sometimes for me what could happen long-term in like 20 years when we allowed mass infection. Right? If we had just allowed mass infection of these other diseases, what that would have looked like. And unfortunately, I think that we might get a taste of that understanding with COVID. Yeah, Daniel.
Yeah, hold on 1 minute. I mean, we already know, right? Because we have 40 years of evidence-based medicine upon which to rely, related to another virus that depletes CD4 cells and productively infects every single cell that has been infected by SARS-CoV-2 in folks' brains. So SARS-CoV-2 and HIV, they both productively infect what are referred to as the perivascular macrophages. They infect the choroid plexus responsible for the production of cerebrospinal fluid. They productively infect astrocytes, brain pericytes, which are known to harbor latent virus, and microglial cells, the primary immune cell of the central nervous system reservoir. With their dysregulation, microglial cells, with the dysregulation of a microglial cell, you'll experience Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Additionally, Parkinson's can develop when there is insult to the substantia nigra, which is part of the basal ganglia. And Daniel Chertow observed viral persistence within the basal ganglia in December of 2021. We also know that amyloid is being deposited in people's brains. This was described a long time ago in what is referred to as the antimicrobial protection hypothesis of Alzheimer's disease. And amyloid can deposit when the threat is either perceived or real, and in this case, it's a real threat in the form of SARS-CoV-2 viremia or virus in the blood. So, you know, we know all of this, right? Drawing parallels, yet we're not doing anything about it. In the very same mechanism that allows virus to spread throughout the brains of those living with HIV is the very same mechanism that is being used by SARS-CoV-2, and that is the tunneling nanotube. It's one form of cell-to-cell transmission or transcytosis, and we have known about that since 2022 with the publishing of Anna Pepe's paper describing that very mechanism being used to propagate virus throughout the brains of our intellectual capital.
Well, and I would say, and I'll get to tact after this, but you know, going to the psychology side of it, though, we can logically know and draw parallels and things, but whether the population at large is going to believe and or uptake that are completely separate things, unfortunately. And that's, again, where the failure of public health and willingness to address these things head on, to have knowledge translation of such studies to work in these areas is failing us greatly. But Tact, I wanted to see, I don't know if we've chatted before. I haven't been on in a while. What's up?
Okay. Sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't think I've ever chatted here particularly. Excuse me. And I'm just getting my voice together here. But what I wanted to talk about, I think you guys just mentioned, I just jumped on, so I kind of missed a lot of what you guys were talking about, but the potential irreversible damage to children's immune systems, to children that are under 12 or 13 years old. This is something that has been really bothering me because the thymus is producing naive T cells up until puberty. And this is well documented and known long before COVID. And the fact that the thymus, along with other organs, but I'm going to focus on the thymus here. Thymus is like the heart of the immune system. And if the thymus is infiltrated or damaged in the process of any virus, which flu can do this, RSV can do this, but COVID's more efficient at doing this. And there's now a couple of studies that show that COVID can infect the thymus and cause thymic involution prior to puberty. So if this process of developing naive T cells is interrupted prior to puberty, you're essentially shortening the lives of every child that is infected. And considering the fact that every single child is being infected multiple times, we're almost guaranteeing that children born today will live much shorter lives and will have a much shorter time of a quality of life than anybody living now. And that is like, a catastrophic tragedy that is completely preventable, that we're not preventing and we're not even seeing. And we will see for another 10 to 20, 30 years. And that's the most insidious part about it.
Yeah, agreed. And I think, again, it's sort of wild to think that we've sort of reverted to living without medical intervention. Like, that's what we're doing at this point, is we're taking the times when life expectancy was shorter, when these things were hurting our population, and we're reverting back to that instead of using every possible intervention that we have and some basic interventions that we have. And the long-term results of that, are fundamentally catastrophic.
Yeah, well, if we think about, like, Epstein-Barr virus causes, mono, which leads to the many different types of autoimmune diseases, chickenpox, the varicella virus, later leads to shingles. But there's so many viruses that stick with us for our entire lives, and that many of them infiltrate our immune system and find these viral reservoirs early in life. And if we had implemented strategies to prevent these viruses early in life, it's an untold number of children and now living adults that wouldn't be suffering with autoimmune issues, that would be living a better quality of life, and that would be living longer lives if we had implemented strategies, decades ago. But we can still do that now. And it's not just COVID that we're worried about, but COVID is, the most transmissible airborne virus currently that we're dealing with, that can infiltrate the immune system and the thymus and the brain and almost every organ system. But it's not the only one. We could implement these strategies of air filtration, ventilation, and significantly improve the lives of generations going forward if we just took the effort, made the investments now.
Yeah, Cindy?
Yeah, there's a syndrome called DeGeorge syndrome, and there's a deletion on chromosome 22 where kids aren't born with a functioning thymus. And in those cases, severe cases, they actually do thymus transplants in those kids, and they can do bone marrow transplants as well. But where are they going to find donors if it was that severe, if it got that severe? Just postulating. I see Dr. Wes is in the room.
Hi, Dr. Wes. Welcome.
I did invite to speak, but I don't know what's going on my end. Can I have more than five people, or do I have to move someone? I don't know how this works.
I think you're good because you have a co-host, so you should have room to add him. He may still be traveling, though, so he may not be able to speak quite yet.
Oh, he just waved. Cindy, for parents that are really concerned about their kids and their immune systems being damaged repeatedly, right? Aside, like, I mean, the anti-vax information that we talked about earlier, that's like another piece altogether. But the parents that are worried about repeat infections and their thymus being damaged, can we get medical doctors like to speak on this as well, like about the thymus and the potential damage it can cause? Because when my child was infected with COVID, you know what, he developed a sudden onset food allergy. We're hearing reports of so many kids with sudden allergies, and he had to now we're EpiPen carriers because of it. And he never had a single food allergy up until after the infection, which was mind blowing to me.
I think an important lesson that everyone is learning from this pandemic is the sheer number of complications that can arise from post-viral infections, not just SARS-CoV-2. You know, but with other viruses that have been largely minimized and in some cases completely ignored. You know, allergies can pop up at any time in life, but definitely, you know, a virus like SARS-CoV-2, it can, you know, roll out the red carpet for things like that to happen. And that information needs to get out to parents. I really don't think they understand, you know, what they're looking at, and that preventing infections is always far better than trying to find cures after the fact when things go awry. There's no benefit to be had from exposing kids to pathogens, preventable disease, none at all. They get everything they need for immunity through their mother and to be exposed to low level anythings. That's just ridiculous.
Cindy, just a side note, can you throw the link up for that paper we were talking about in the thread, just because I know somebody's asking for it and other people are probably interested in that IG4 paper?
Sure. Yep, sure will.
Mel, I'm hoping you can chat for a bit because my child is wanting dinner right now, so I need to quickly make a grilled cheese.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to go back to what Cindy and I were talking about earlier about how, you know, we're seeing this purposeful twisting of scientific information, right? And it's purposeful in many ways, probably. I mean, we can theorize, Cindy, I mean, could it possibly be, you know, to hide liability reasons, you know, to hide previous statements they made that they were wrong, and it is to, you know, to protect their own egos. But on a larger scale, you know, how would that even translate to the effects that it's had? Because we're talking about these very few individuals that are purposely twisting truth to protect themselves. But then we see a much larger machine working to encourage this let it rip, right? The vax and relax. We see it everywhere, and we are now starting to get a glimpse of the consequences. We're finding out, as Crystal said, you know, and it makes me think about this podcast that we had last season where Sunshiny came on and she discussed how we are in the thick of it, of the demoralization phase, right? There are these phases, she said, you know, first comes the demoralization and then the dehumanization and then a crisis and then a normalization. And in a way, we're in the crisis normalization phase right now. We are right in it. And I want to point out that these four phases is just not a willy-nilly phases. These are actually four steps to totalitarianism, as outlined by Yuri Bezmenov. I did further research, Cindy, and I was chatting with Samantha Kuttner from Glitter Pill LLC, the chief intelligence officer, and she just recently had their testimony at the UN about alt-right extremism. And I was chatting with Samantha, and we were discussing how it almost seems like the bigger machine of moving societal norms and moving things and changing the norms where the people are accepting, we were accepting the sickness, we're accepting this, these lies about immune deficiency and paying your immunity debt. But when you zoom out, when I was discussing this with Samantha, we looked back at one of her older podcasts where she had an interview with Eric Brichetto, which is a disinformation researcher. And out of the disinformation researcher, he was actually looking into old FSB PDFs and old KGB PDFs. And they were discussing about the reflexive control and how so many people in the United States have bought into QAnon talks. And I saw actually the parallels and how the entire Great Barrington Declaration and bringing down and the destruction of global public health everywhere, where we are literally reprogramming humans to accept reinfection and thinking that it's okay. And part of the disinformation research that's coming out is that the information on reflexive control is that information is a weapon, and the information can be used to impact particular minds. And this particular political scientist, this Russian political scientist called Restergiev, he calls it performing work on an object and moving it in a particular direction and belief system. And you can do this with information weapons and social media, which we are seeing. We're seeing coordinated attacks on discouraging vaccine uptakes. We're seeing coordinated messaging on twisting scientific research, as Cindy is pointing out, where they're taking parts of important papers like the IgG4 paper and saying that the vaccines are going to give you turbo cancer. This is all part of information manipulation, part of disinformation, but it's also part of manipulation of belief systems, where you are basically going to reprogram humans to operate under their own volition through deception and to be able restructuring entire cultures and corrupting them for their purposes. Like, it's a step-by-step operation, psychological information, PSYOP, where the FSB breaks down how they're using tactics, Stasi tactics, and Restergiev, to move society and move people's belief systems. And we're actually seeing this happening in real time. Like, looking back and going back and seeing how we've documented how they slowly pushed things little bit by little bit where we would accept it, you know, where they slowly dehumanize children dying, saying, oh, they had comorbidities. It makes it's a psychological ploy where we accept death. Whereas before, we would be mortified that there's like been three dead kids just in this little province in the last 10 days. But the child deaths en masse, and like if we were to zoom out, the child deaths are in the thousands, hundreds of thousands. We have just completely numbed ourselves to this. We have habituated to the death because the work is being done on us psychologically.
You raise some very, really good points. This is exactly, if you look, study, if you look at in Germany, how people that live down the street from the Nazi camps, they lived life as if, life was normal because they were being told that whatever was happening down the street was fine. And they just didn't want to see it. They just agreed with whatever they were being told. And because that was the easiest path forward, they just went with it. And that's just pretty much how things are going right now in the United States, Europe, and most of the world. You know, we're being told that COVID's fine, no big deal. Meanwhile, there's thousands of people dying, thousands, every single week. And yet, everybody's fine with it because it's just a virus, But it's just like, it's the same mentality. People just put it out of their minds and make it okay because, thousands would be dying, thousands would be getting disabled. But as long as it's not happening to them, and as long as the majority, as long as the politicians have control of the majority and the majority isn't being infected in a way that will change their behavior, then they can control the situation. The second that switches over, then it's going to flip-flop. But currently, it's still on the side of the majority is not being impacted enough to sway the politicians to change their behavior.
Well, and they're relying on cognitive dissonance, right? This idea that we will revert what we think simply so that we can keep behaving in the ways that we want. People don't want to wear masks, so they use every reason that they're told that they don't have to wear them. People don't want to have to take these steps to protect other people, so they're given every belief and reason that they don't need to. And that just feeds into, unfortunately, the majority of the population's psychology and makes it super freaking easy for them to do it.
Well, there are some other layers to this. Well, there's a lot of other layers to this, but one of those layers is the blood types. If anybody's researched this, the blood types that somebody has creates a certain level of protection from this virus and probably some other viruses, although the research isn't there. But for example, O positive blood type, which makes up about 34 to 38% of the population, is much less likely to be infected than AB or AB. And AB and B negative is the most likely to be infected, and that only makes up 13% of the population. So I don't know I doubt any of these politicians did this math, but if they did, then it would make sense to them from a mathematical standpoint that far fewer people are going to be negatively impacted than the 13% that would be the most impacted. And therefore, politically, it's a good decision. But it's a horrible decision from a standpoint of humanity and morality and ethically.
Well, and they used such reasoning from the beginning, though, because I think when COVID was first hitting and the first deaths were hitting, Trump in the U.S., really leaned into the fact that Black populations were dying, right? And that gave all of the people that weren't of that population the reason to not think about it and not care. And we saw a reduction in masking, particularly among white populations, right? That they felt the ability to decrease the protection methods because it wasn't their problem.
Yeah, I saw that too. It was really fascinating and scary to watch how quickly, you know, white people were able to be, oh, okay, well, it's not going to affect me, so therefore I don't have to mask as or take as much precautions. And I currently live in a space that is I can travel a mile one direction and be in a very white community. Travel a mile different direction and be in a very, you know, dark community, darker, you know, skin community. And interestingly, everybody, I was you know, at Home Depot and Walmart earlier today, towards the minority community, dark community, darker skin community, and everybody's wearing masks, everybody, which was, kind of shocking, but also, you know, great to see. But it was at a much higher percentage than if I just went 2 miles north, which was, it was kind of mind-boggling to me. But there's no difference in messaging that I'm aware of. But yet the masks were there and not there in other places. So it was really interesting.
Mel, you spoke to that quite a while ago, going back to the Asian supermarkets because the masking was better there. Did you not?
Yeah. I don't get any flack when I shop at Asian supermarkets with my respirator or at Costco. Actually, I'm noticing more people at Costco shopping with respirators on. But for some reason, the only place I got harassed at was at the Real Canadian Superstore. But I don't know if it's because there's like a lot of white people that shop there. But yeah, the only people who have ever yelled at me for wearing a respirator has been white people. And I don't know if it's because I'm like visibly Asian. So I don't know if it's because they think they can just yell at me. Like, would they do that to another white person wearing a respirator? Like, these are things that I just don't get.
Well,
as a neurodivergent person, like I don't get it.
As a white man, I can tell you, I've yelled at white people and other people, everybody basically. I don't see color. Is this way the way I look at it? But when I could, I do. When there's rules in place, I tell everybody to wear their mask, whether I'm in a store, no matter where I am, and generally they listen.
Yeah, but coming from you, like a white privileged man wearing a respirator, yelling at another white person, comes across very differently as a woman of color wearing a respirator telling white people to wear a respirator. There's a huge difference because I would never be able to say that. Like a white person would look at me and just ignore me and walk away. Like, until I open my mouth and I sound like a white person, they're going to assume that I don't speak English. I hate to say this, but even in a multicultural country and like Canada, there's still an assumption.
I still don't know why people listen to me, honestly. But so many people actually just stop with their masks half over their nose and lift it up and put it in place. It is shocking.
That is the joy of being part of the privileged group, right? And I say that as a white woman in terms of, you know, in my office, there are conversations that happen and I push back a lot towards people because I know I won't get in trouble for it most of the times compared to other people if they were making those arguments, like Mel, right? So what I'm saying there, Mel, is that we could both be saying the same thing and she's going to take more shit for it. So I take it as a responsibility in my position to do that more. And I hope that, you know, for most of us, when we come from privileged groups, that we do that. But Mel, I think we should probably start wrapping it up. But I'm thinking, and I hesitate to say this because my 2023 was such a clusterfuck, but maybe we'll get back to sort of doing a bi-weekly biweekly episode on here and then putting it out on the website for the podcast.
I would love that. I miss everyone here. And gosh, it's not a good feeling to see everything that we've been talking about for 3 years come to fruition. Like, that's not anything that we want to happen. Like, I don't like seeing the destruction of the pillars of our democracy happening in real time. I don't like seeing foreign ops and Russian propaganda and Russian disinformation.
Complete healthcare collapse. Just yeah, putting that in there.
Things. Yeah, I mean, like, it's not like we were warned. I mean, NATO published a whole article about, you know, Russian disinformation, and the anti-vaccine movement is Russian disinformation op. Like, but no one pays attention to it because, you know, people who go to Facebook and Instagram for their news are not going to listen to that.
Yeah, we'll be some annoying voices around again. Well, that's good.
And thank you, Cindy, for co-hosting with us today. Thank you for your translation and being patient with us when we're not at the science Jedi level that you are.
Yeah, thanks, Cindy. And maybe, Mel, I'm thinking we'll see if Sam wants to come back on in the future.
Absolutely. And thank you all for everyone being here. And thank you for all that you do and using your voices while we've taken a break. And it's nice to be back. And with that, we'll say have a good evening, everyone. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.